Chapter 35. Houses of Death. The late Professor Francis Camps did not look in the least like a crime doctor. A cheerful, untidy man in baggy clothes, he might have been a farmer or an auctioneer. He was, in fact, one of the most brilliant of English pathologists since the great Sir Bernard Spilsbury. On March the 24th, 1953, he became involved in an investigation into a death house murder case that received wider publicity than any criminal affair since Jack the Ripper. Late that afternoon, he was contacted by the Criminal Investigation Department of Notting Hill Police Station in West London. They had received a five-word message: "Woman's body found in cupboard." Camps packed his murder bag and joined the murder squad detectives at a squalid, grimy-looking house at the end of a cul-de-sac. Its address, 10 Rillington Place, became as familiar to the British public as 10 Downing Street. Earlier that evening, the current tenant, Beresford Brown, had been tapping the wall at the end of the kitchen, looking for a place to put up brackets for a radio set. The wall sounded so hollow that he pulled off a strip of paper and found a cupboard door with a corner missing. He shone a torch through the hole and saw the naked back of a woman. When Camps arrived, the police had stripped the remaining paper from the door and opened it. The seated woman was not quite naked. She was wearing a suspender belt and a brassiere, and also a jacket and a pullover. These had been pulled up so that a strip of blanket could be tied to her brassiere, then fixed to the wall to prevent her from falling forward. When the police removed the body, they spotted another victim, shrouded in a blanket and propped up against the wall. They took it out and came across a third body, also standing upright and wrapped in a blanket. When the corpses were laid out in the next room, they proved to be those of three young women, all in their mid-twenties. A further search of the house revealed yet more corpses under the dining room floor, this time of a woman in her fifties. She was soon identified as a previous tenant of the flat, Mrs. Ethel Christie. Her husband, John Christie, had left the place only 3 days earlier. The corpses in the cupboard were remarkably well preserved. A constant stream of air had started to mummify them. Camps took vaginal swabs and quickly established that the motive for the murders had been sexual. The girls had each had intercourse shortly before or after death. But where was Christie? A nationwide alert went out for him. Surkov, head of the Russian Writers' Union, who was on a visit to England at the time, remarked contemptuously that the capitalist press seemed more interested in the bodies of women found in a cupboard than in political realities. But this was hardly fair. A mass murderer was apparently at liberty, and he might kill again. Camps recalled that there had been two other murders in the same house 4 years earlier: Mrs. Beryl Evans and her daughter Geraldine. The husband, Timothy Evans, had confessed to the crimes and had been hanged. At one point, however, he had accused Christie of being the killer. No one had taken his accusation seriously, either in the police station or at the trial. Now, as the police combed the death house, they discovered a human femur propping up the fence in the garden. Digging uncovered two more skeletons, both female. Camps examined the other bodies at the nearby Kensington mortuary. The three bodies from the cupboard showed signs of carbon monoxide poisoning, coal gas, and they had been strangled. The murder hunt for Christie ended a week later when he was recognised by a policeman as he stood on Putney Bridge. He made no attempt to escape. He was a tall, thin, bald-headed man in his fifties. He seemed exhausted and confused, but he confessed to the murders. When Camps examined Christie's shoes, he made a curious discovery. There were definite traces of semen on them. Christie had not only raped his victims, he had also masturbated as he stood above them. The enigma of Christie's mind began to fascinate Camps as much as the forensic details that emerged from his examination. And as detectives slowly uncovered the evidence of Christie's past, he began to gain some insight into the motivations of this middle-aged, quietly-spoken monster. The police investigation showed that Christie had committed 8 murders between 1943 and 1953, including, most probably, that of the baby Geraldine Evans. He had lured women to the house when his wife was away, killed and sexually assaulted them, and then concealed the bodies, except in the case of Mrs. Evans. He had disposed of his wife in December 1952 and followed this by a 3-month murder spree, slaughtering the women whose bodies were found in the cupboard. Many sex murderers are subnormal men who kill without considering the consequences of their acts. But Christie was a man who gave an impression of intelligence and control. He had appeared as a witness in the trial of Timothy Evans and had been complimented by the judge on the clarity of his evidence. What had driven such a man to an orgy of killing for which he was almost certain to be hanged? Little by little, Camps pieced together the evidence of the strange life of John Reginald Halliday Christie. He had been born in Yorkshire in 1898, the son of a harsh, stern father, a carpenter. Christie was a born loser, weak, myopic, always ill. He was inclined to pilfering and was usually caught. His father beat him brutally on these occasions. When he lost his job as a clerk through petty theft, his father threw him out of the house. At some time during his teens, he had a traumatic sexual experience. He took a girl out to Lover's Lane and she led him on to have intercourse. At the crucial moment, his nerve broke and he failed. The girl repeated the story and he became known in the area as Reggie No Dick or Can't Do It Christie. During the 1914 war, he was mustard gassed and blown up. How far he suffered a real disability is not known, but it encouraged his lifelong tendency to hypochondria. Periodically, he suffered from blindness and from a loss of voice due to hysteria. At 22, he was married to Ethel, but it was 2 years before he was able to have sexual intercourse with her. The hysterical fear of failure remained. They had no children. And then, in 1934, he was knocked down by a car and suffered head injuries. Due to his handicaps, he earned low wages as an unskilled clerk. Yet he had a tendency to boast and to show off. At one point, he even became a member of the Halifax Yorkshire Conservative Association and encouraged the rumour that he had been a rich man when he married, but had lost his money. In 1939, he became a War Reserve policeman. It was what he had always wanted, authority. But he abused it by acting as a petty tyrant, taking pleasure in issuing summonses for minor blackout offences. He was still a constable in 1943 when he invited a woman called Ruth Fuerst back to his London home. But he was incapable of sex with a fully conscious woman, even if she was willing, so he devised a way to render his girlfriends unconscious. He claimed that he had an ideal remedy for catarrh and various nasal ailments, a mixture of friar's balsam and other ingredients mixed with boiling water. The bowl had to be covered with a cloth to prevent the steam from escaping, and the patient had to breathe in the vapour. Christie then connected a rubber tube up to the gas tap and allowed the gas to bubble through the hot liquid. When the girl was dizzy or unconscious, he carried her to the bedroom, raped her, and then strangled her. When he had satisfied his desires in a kind of frenzy that came from years of frustration, he knew he had to kill the girl to prevent her from charging him. In this way, he killed Ruth Thuerst in 1943 and Muriel Eady, a friend of his wife's, in 1944, also during his wife's absence. In 1949, his neighbour, Timothy Evans, who lived in the flat above, confided in Christie that his wife was pregnant again and that he wanted to procure an abortion. Christie immediately claimed that he was an expert abortionist and agreed to do it one morning when Evans was at work. It seems fairly certain that when Christie saw Beryl Evans half-naked, he lost control of himself, beat her unconscious and raped her. After this, he killed her and the baby Geraldine. Perhaps the strangest feature of the murder is that Christie then somehow persuaded Timothy Evans that his wife had died during the abortion and that he, Evans, would be blamed unless he fled. Evans did so, and the police assumed that he was the murderer. When caught, he proved to be mentally subnormal, and later, after questioning, readily confessed. No one will ever know what went on in Evans' mind when he discovered that Beryl and Geraldine had been strangled. In 1952, Christie's violent urges again reached a climax, but his wife was there to prevent him realising them. In December, he strangled her and buried her body under the floor. Then, early in January, he invited Rita Nelson, a prostitute, to the house. He went through the usual procedure of persuading her to inhale gas, then raped and strangled her. In all probability, he kept the body around for several days before putting it in the cupboard. A few days later, he raped and strangled another prostitute, Kathleen Maloney. During these murders, he was like a starving man eating his fill for the first time. In a confession, he later described the enormous sense of peace that came over him afterwards. But the danger of being caught was growing keener. Ethel's relatives were getting worried. Christie had no job. He had sold his furniture. He was going to pieces. There was one more victim, Hectorina McLennan, the mistress of an out-of-work Irishman. Christie had allowed them to sleep in the flat overnight. Then he lured the woman back the next day and killed her. His final act in the death house was to pack the bodies of his victims into a cupboard and to cover it with wallpaper. Christie was executed for his crimes on July the 15th, 1953. 19 years later, No. 10 Rillington Place was demolished, together with the rest of the street, whose name had by then been changed to Ruston Close to discourage sightseers. It's now a truck park. But in the far corner of the park, one can still see the outer walls and the floor that once belonged to Britain's most notorious death house. In his posthumously published book, Camps on Crime, Francis Camps has described another case of a body in a cupboard, which was investigated by his friend, Dr. Gerald Evans of Rhyl, North Wales. In May 1960, a widow of 65 named Sarah Harvey was taken to hospital for observation. During her absence, her son decided to redecorate her house, 35 West Kinwell Street. On the landing, there was a large wooden cupboard that had been locked for many years. Mr. Harvey opened this and recoiled. On the floor, there was a hunched shape covered with a sheet. A discoloured human foot grotesquely protruded from one corner of it. The police were at once called, together with Dr. Evans, and when the rotting cloth was cautiously pulled away from the body, they saw a brown, mummified body, whose skin was as hard as granite. It seemed to be a woman. The mummy was placed in glycerine to soften it, and then examined. There was a mark around the neck, which could have been due to a ligature, and there were fragments of a stocking stuck to it. In hospital, Mrs. Harvey explained that the corpse was that of an old lady named Frances Knight, who had come to live with her in 1940. One night, she said, Mrs. Knight had died in pain. Mrs. Harvey then panicked and pushed her body into the cupboard. She continued to collect the £2 a week due to Mrs. Knight as the result of a court order for the next 20 years. The presence of the stocking gave rise to suspicion of murder, and Mrs. Harvey was put on trial. The defence pointed out that many working-class people have a custom of curing sore throats by wrapping an unwashed sock or stocking around the neck. Mrs. Knight could have done this and accidentally strangled herself, or perhaps she had died of natural causes and the neck had swollen after death, producing the mark on the flesh. The court gave Mrs. Harvey the benefit of the doubt. The trial was stopped after 3 days, but she was found guilty of obtaining £2 a week for 20 years under false pretences and sentenced to 15 months in prison. The Christie case and the Rhyl mummy case make it clear why murder houses are so rare. It's true, of course, that many murders are committed in houses, but it's only under exceptional circumstances that the body is then kept in the house. It's not a wise thing to do, as Crippen discovered to his cost when he buried Belle Elmore in the cellar of his North London home. When a man is suspected of murder, his house is the first place the police search. The consequence is that although horror stories are full of houses with corpses hidden under the floorboards and behind the walls, it very seldom happens in practice. Really professional murderers understand the importance of disposing of the body as far as possible from home. The result is that not only were no bodies ever found at Landrieu's murder house in Gombay, no bloodstains or other evidence was found either. Even the calcined bones, reported by the Times, proved to be an unfounded rumour. H. H. Holmes, the master of Murder Castle in Chicago, discovered the most ingenious way of disposing of the bodies of his 20 or so victims. He hired a workman to strip off the skin, claimed that the people had died normally, and that their corpses were intended for a medical school. The village of Tsinkota, near Budapest, can claim to possess a genuine death house at 17 Ratsotsky Street. Its owner had gone to the war in 1914 and was never to be seen again. In May 1916, the house was put up for sale by the local authorities to pay for its back taxes. It was bought by a blacksmith, István Molnár. Molnár became curious about 7 large tin drums concealed behind a pile of old metal in the workshop. A few days later, he forced one open and recoiled when confronted by the naked corpse of a woman. The other barrels also proved to contain female corpses. Detective Geza Bielkowski, in charge of the case, found it baffling. He looked through the files of more than 400 missing women before he found one that seemed to fit. She was a 36-year-old cook called Anna Novak, and her ex-employer was still resentful because she had left without giving notice. Her trunk was in the attic, and in it the detective found the first clue, a newspaper advertisement. Young man seeks female companion for walking tour in Alps, marriage possible. It gave a P.O. box number 717. A search of Budapest newspapers revealed that advertisements involving box 717 had appeared 20 times in 2 years. The box was apparently owned by Mr. Elimir Nodge, but the address was 17 Radzotsky Street, Tsinkota. Nodge's handwriting was reproduced in newspapers, and a lady came forward to say that it was the handwriting of her fiancé, Bella Kiss. She had last received a postcard from him in 1914. Kiss had apparently been killed in battle. The police obtained a photograph from his regiment and showed it around Budapest's red light district. They discovered that Kiss was a man of boundless sexual appetite, in fact a satyr. He was well-dressed, a gentleman, and he paid well for his sexual pleasures. It was his physical drive which led him into the business of lady-killing. His advertisements lured spinsters with savings into his death-house home. They ended up in metal drums, and their savings were spent on prostitutes. Kiss was never traced. He may have been killed in battle. One rumour has it that he changed identities with a dead soldier and later emigrated to America. In the United States, the town of Plainfield, Wisconsin, also possesses a death house with a history as lurid as that of 10 Rillington Place or 17 Radzotsky Street, the residence of a gentle, quiet man named Ed Gine, whose obvious inoffensiveness made him a favourite babysitter in the area. One afternoon in November 1957, a deputy sheriff, Frank Warden, called at the Gine farm. Warden's mother, who kept a grocery store in the area, had disappeared, leaving a pool of blood on the floor and a cash register showing that her last customer had been the mild-mannered Ed. When Warden found that the farmhouse was empty, he looked into the woodshed and saw the corpse of his mother, naked and headless, hanging upside down from the ceiling. The body had been dressed like a carcass in a butcher's shop. He re-entered the farm and in the dining room discovered a woman's heart in a dish. Mrs. Warden's head and intestines were in a box nearby. Gine, out at supper with a neighbour, was quickly arrested. He admitted committing the murder, but claimed that he had been in a daze at the time. Detectives made a full-scale search of the farmhouse, which was indescribably filthy and untidy, and found no less than 10 skins flayed from human heads and a box containing noses. Human skin had been used to repair leather armchairs and even to make a belt. Gine had been living on his own at the farmhouse since 1945, and from his admissions the police constructed an incredible story. His mother had been violently religious, convinced that God was about to destroy the world because women wore lipstick. She instilled into Gine a highly ambivalent hatred of scarlet women. Gine's father died in 1940, his only brother in 1942. Old Mrs. Gine suffered a stroke in 1944, and Gine nursed her until her death a year later. Then, alone in the house, he began to suffer from tormenting sexual passions. In 1942, he had called at a neighbour's house and seen a woman wearing shorts. That night, a man had broken into the house and asked the woman's son where his mother was. The intruder fled, but the boy thought that he had recognised Gine. Not long after his mother's death, Gine saw an announcement in a newspaper that a woman was being buried. That night he drove to the graveyard, dug up the body and put it in his truck, then replaced the coffin and buried it carefully. Back at home he at last had a woman to share his bed. "It gave me a lot of satisfaction," he explained. He found the corpse so sexually exciting that he ate part of the body and made a waistcoat of the skin so he could wear it next to his body. At Christmas 1957, Gine was found insane and confined for life to the Wopan State Hospital. So the death houses, castles, apartments, farms, stay where and sometimes as they are until they're renovated or raised. People live in the buildings, in the bedrooms and lounges in which the murders were committed, frequently without knowing the previous bloody history of their homes. The death houses keep their secrets to themselves. Their walls may have ears, but they did not have tongues.